I said something yesterday in answer to a question, and it occurred to me in the following hour that what I said is probably not correct. So let me try to set it straight. We had a hierarchy yesterday of importance. And we said the most important consideration was a person who earns the right to live in justice, through justice, through the strictest possible standards. That's so important that God will even frustrate a criminal's free will. We said, why is that? I speculated, because the person who earned the right to live according to the strict standards of justice, his life, his free will is so important that it takes precedence over the free will of the criminals. Then we said, on the other hand, the person survives only through mercy. He can be hurt through the free will of the criminals, probably because the person survives through mercy is himself a criminal. And then, measuring one criminal level against another criminal level may not be relevant. It's a question of interfering with free will. But everything was based on comparisons of free will. So it was asked, would there be anything else other than free will that would be a reason to overrule somebody's free will? Now, I said I didn't think so. But it occurred to me afterwards that I do know of a counterexample, and that makes the situation much more complicated. I've mentioned it a number of times in here, it just didn't occur to me on the spot. Maimonides says that God took away Pharaoh's free will so as to be able to punish him. If Pharaoh had his free will, then he could have used it to do tshuva. Doing tshuva would have prevented his punishment. God wanted him punished under all conditions. Therefore, he took away his free will. Maybe I can wiggle out. At any rate, it seems there that God took away Pharaoh's free will in order to be able to punish him. It doesn't sound like there that God is taking away Pharaoh's free will for the sake of some other free will benefit, some other promotion of free will. It sounds like he's taking away Pharaoh's free will for the sake of some other consideration that has nothing to do with free will. But actually, as I'm speaking to you, maybe I can still wiggle out. Because what the Rambam says is this. After the fifth plague, God could have ended Pharaoh's life off of him. That's another way of taking away free will. Very absolute, very final, very dramatic. When a person dies, he has no more free will. So Maimonides says, why did he keep him alive and take away his free will rather than having him die, which would take away his free will? Either way, you could guarantee that he'll be punished. So he says, because he wanted to use Pharaoh as an example of how far a person can go in corruption, that he can get to the point where God will take away his free will. So now, is leaving Pharaoh alive and taking away his free will while he's alive for the sake of making an example for other people that they should learn from it and thereby make better choices? If so, maybe you could parlay it again into an effect of on free will. I'm not sure. And what about the other people who are supposed to learn from this? I'm not sure. So I have to say at least what I said yesterday. I can't defend the detail. And it may require some more thought. Okay, I mentioned something at the beginning of the week. We have a few more days before the new group comes in. This is something that I teach, but not often. It's an important idea. It was not simple. On the other hand, this group has given me so much pleasure and satisfaction over the last couple of months. The kind of responses that I've gotten from you have been so stimulating and on the ball that I have decided to try to go through this with you and go through it with you in over a few days so that it'll be reasonably well understood. How does Torah relate to morality? Right and wrong, good and evil, justice. How does Torah relate to morality? I told you that there are two views. One view is simple, clear, precise, intuitive, convincing, wonderful to use to beat up the atheist and false. And the other view is complicated, subtle, difficult to understand. You have to squash your intuitions a bit to make it work, make it palatable. And it's true. So I'm going to describe the false position to you. And today, start the explanation why it's false. Hopefully, tomorrow, I'll finish the explanation why it's false. And then, Sunday and Monday, I'll tell you what the true view is.
But it's different to what you're doing tonight.
Yes. Although there's a little overlap, but that's what I'm doing today. It's much more complicated. That's why I'm doing it over 4 days. So there'll be time for discussion. Hopefully so that it will be reasonably well understood. Here's the false view. God's command creates morality. Without God, or without God commanding, that is to say, if you're an atheist, or maybe you believe in God, but God never told us to do anything, then nothing is really right or wrong. Nothing is really good or bad. Nothing is really just or unjust. I think it was Dostoevsky has one of his characters say, if there is no God, then everything is permitted. Everything's permitted. Now, you understand how convenient this view is to beat up the atheist. You say to the atheist, and this works very well in public, say to him, tell me, what do you think of Nazis? Oh, they're terrible, and so on and so on. Well, if you don't believe in God, then nothing is really evil. So if you want to condemn the Nazis, really condemn them, you better really believe in God. Because if you don't really believe in God, then nothing is really evil, including Nazis. That's great. No, people find it very difficult to respond to that and put the atheist in a terrible corner. Yeah?
And they just respond that it's relative to that? Is there more evil than anything that's come before? It's not an absolute, but it's just more so than anything.
You're now using the word relative, I think, in a way that you don't intend. If I say that A is taller than B, that's in your sense, the sense you're using now at this moment, that's a relative statement. But surely it's an absolute fact. It's an absolute fact that A is taller than B. So this use of relative doesn't deprive the thing of the status of being an objective fact. It's a universal fact, a fact for everyone, a fact you can prove. That use of relative is not opposed to absolute. In fact, maybe you should use the word relational. It's a relational statement. It describes a relationship between one thing and another.
Okay.
That doesn't make it non-absolute. Okay. Golem is a weasel word. It has lots of different applications, and they're very rarely thought through. At any rate, so what's wrong with Satan? What's wrong with saying, without God, or without God's commanding, nothing is really right or wrong, nothing is really good or evil? And why would anybody think it's true? Why do I think that it is correct? Let's start with that. Let's think about why they think it's true, what reasons they give for it. And then I'll show you that the reasons are not not only not adequate, but they don't count at all. And then we'll talk about some of the merits of the idea. If you ask people, why do you think that without God, nothing is really right or wrong? The answer you get is, well, if there is no God, then there's no standard. There's nothing you could appeal to establish what is really right and what's really wrong. Seems that without God, then you have different people with different ideas and different societies, different cultures, different times in history, different philosophies. There's nothing to make it really right and really wrong. Therefore, you don't have God to be that standard. Nothing can be really right or wrong. Now, the truth is that this reason is really an appeal to ignorance. It's an appeal to ignorance. What it says is, if I don't use God, then I have no standard. That's probably true. Why? Because if I don't use God, I can't think of another standard. I can't imagine another standard. I never heard of another standard. No one has ever suggested another standard. Okay. Does that mean there is no other standard? Seems to me all it means is that up until now, we haven't found another standard. Doesn't mean there is none. The fact that we haven't found one doesn't mean there isn't any. It just means that we don't have any way to give it a standard. We haven't discovered a standard. We haven't imagined a standard. That doesn't mean there is none. It's much more difficult to prove that there is none. Take a couple of parallels. To this date, there's no known cure for cancer. No one has ever thought of one. No one has proposed one. Or the ones who proposed one have proven to be wrong. They've all been refuted. Would anyone say, therefore, there is no cure for cancer? Well, then what are everybody doing research for? What they say is, we've been trying to find it. We haven't found it. Maybe in the future we will find it. Let's think about the stars. 2,000 years ago, there were all sorts of theories about what the stars are, what makes them shine. The one that I like best is that the night sky, the black night sky, is a piece of black velvet. And in the velvet there are holes. Behind the back of the black velvet is a sea of light. And the light comes through the holes in the velvet. And what we call stars are the holes in the velvet letting the light through. Now, you look at the sky, now could you prove that's wrong? No. Okay, so there are all sorts of weird ideas about what the stars are. Did anybody have any way to prove what the stars are, to theorize about what the stars are, to explain why the stars shine, to say where they come from, to say what they're made out of? No. Lots of people made up fantasies, but no one had any way to determine what the stars are made out of, why they shine, where they came from. But in the 20th century, more or less, people came to an understanding of what they're made of, and why they shine, where they came from. The fact that 2,000 years ago, we really had nothing to say. We just had nothing to say about it. doesn't mean there isn't any fact there. It just means that we had no access to those facts. I'll give you another example. There was a discipline called alchemy. Alchemy was the attempt to turn base metals into gold and to find the elixir of everlasting life. Immortality. Now these people did loads of experiments and they wrote them up and they corresponded with one another. And they checked each other's experiments for accuracy. The only trouble was that they could never agree on the results of the experiments. One alchemist would do it in Paris and report these results. The alchemist would try it in Berlin and write back and say, I don't know, we tried the same experiment. Got entirely different results. Why? Because they would describe the experiment this way. At 3 minutes past midnight, I put in the three rodent tails and the four toads, and I boiled the water, and I wore the conical black hat, and I recited the incantation, and it turned brown. So the guy in Berlin says, I tried exactly the same thing. Didn't work. The guy in Paris writes back, do you remember the conical black hat? Did you remember to do it 3 minutes past midnight? What clock did you use to make sure it was 3 minutes past midnight? Maybe that's your problem. But they didn't specify the material of the pot, or what kind of water it was, or whether it was clean, and they didn't specify which rodents they took the things from, just rodent tails. So they were specifying the wrong features. They were missing out on the right features. Which features are they that determine what the results will be? It took centuries by long, painful experimentation to figure out that black hat doesn't matter, and 3 minutes after midnight doesn't matter, but when you put it in a copper pot, or a ceramic pot, or an iron pot, or a brass pot, it makes a big difference in the results. And whether you use mice, or rats, or other types of rodents, could make a big difference. So, if you would ask people in the middle of the era of alchemy, what's going on here? What kind of activity is this? What standards do you have? What method do you use? You get 10 different methods from 10 different people and no agreement on the results. That doesn't mean there is no standard. It just means they didn't discover a standard. They hadn't found the standard. Would have been grossly immature to say, because we haven't found a standard, there isn't a standard. It's just when you mix these things up, they do things and different things at different times, and there's no way to tell what they do. The truth was, they hadn't discovered the way to tell what they do. It doesn't follow that there is no way to tell what they do. Modern psychology is in a somewhat similar situation. Because you ask modern psychologists, what are you studying and how are you studying it, and you get radically different answers. One group says we're studying behavior. All that matters is how the body moves. Nothing else matters. Of course, chattering away is also more bodily motions. They're called behaviorists. Others are saying we're studying the physiology of the brain. Behavior is just a window on how the brain is organized. Psychology is about what's going on in the brain. And another group, the therapists, are talking about, say that we're studying the psyche, whatever that is, and we're discovering its own inner dynamics. And that's a third realm altogether. Ask each school what the value of introspection is. I feel like this. You get three different stories. They don't agree on what the subject is. They don't agree on what methods to use. Does that mean there are no facts of psychology? No, it just means that psychology is a mess. Intellectually, it's a mess. As some people put it, psychology has not had its Newton. A great genius who can pull everything together and identify the key concepts and the key methods so as to organize all the material. It hasn't had a student yet. So it's in a mess. So from the fact that we have not discovered a standard for right and wrong, doesn't follow that there isn't a standard for right and wrong. It just means that we're in a pickle. We're in confusion over this matter. And indeed, throughout the centuries, there have been philosophers who have tried to propose a standard. No one said, how foolish you are. trying to pose a standard? Don't you know that without God there can't be a standard? No one took that position. What they said was, okay, you're trying to propose a standard. Let's take a look at it. Does it work? Does it work? Usually they found so many counterexamples to the standard. They said, well, it was a good try, but it doesn't fit. That doesn't mean the next one can't fit. So the argument that they give for this idea that without God there can't be absolute morality is really an appeal to ignorance. We haven't found one yet, and then they go on to say that therefore there can't be one. Not at all. It simply doesn't follow. Yeah.
But in a way, it's non-falsifiable, and all these people that tried to propose a standard, like utilitarianism and all, they were trying to propose a way where they thought that they could make people live the best way, but it would still be not binding on everybody, because even if utilitarianism works perfectly in all aspects, it doesn't bind anybody to it, it still goes back to there's no overriding force. And even if everybody in the world believes in a certain thing, like we shouldn't hit babies or whatever, some principle, some very specific principle, even if everybody in the world agrees to it, it still doesn't bind anybody.
Okay, let me briefly point out what I think the mistakes are in what you're saying. First of all, falsifiability is red herring. Falsifiability is irrelevant to any significant question. Popper has been refuted. He was refuted 60 years ago, even 40 years ago when I was in graduate school. We knew he was wrong. Just hasn't filtered out to the general public yet. If you need a refutation of Popper, I can give it to you, but it's probably in-house material. I can give you a reading list on it. Falsifiability is just a wrong issue. Should leave it out. It's a red herring. This idea of it's not being binding, the way you're putting it, is also a red herring. I'll explain why. True. If we had a standard, and the standard met all of the criteria, and it solved all the questions, and it fit all the data, it wouldn't bind anyone, force him to accept it. That's correct. That's correct, but totally irrelevant. Compare truth. Suppose that we establish on the basis of irrefutable evidence that something is true. Does that force anyone to believe it? It doesn't force anyone to believe it. A person's free to disagree with the evidence and just go, but it doesn't mean it's not true. It is true. It is true. He, unfortunately, isn't responding to the truth. Now, the fact that we have a standard for morality, which is a satisfactory standard, and he still commits evil, or he refuses to acknowledge it, doesn't mean that it's not valid, that it's not correct, it's not accurate, genuine, real, objective. It just means that he's out of step with objectivity. That happens all the time with people. The fact that millions of people who disbelieved in the Holocaust doesn't mean that the Holocaust isn't an objective event. It just means that they've chosen not to respond to the objective truth. So the fact that a person is not forced, that is to say, no force makes him do the right thing, or makes him agree that it's the right thing, doesn't mean it's not objectively correct. It has nothing to do with it. That's not the kind, that's that kind of force for binding this that's relevant to a moral standard.
Would we know what the truth even looked like if we saw it, though? That's what I'm really trying to, like, we know that, what the truth of a Holocaust would look like, but how would we know a truth of morality? Like,
how would the alchemists know what the truth of chemistry would look like when they're in the midst of a confusion where they can't agree on the outcomes of experiments? So what? In this physical area, they can't agree on what to do, they can't agree on what happened, they can't agree on whether they got it right or didn't get it right. So what is physical? This looked to them like an area of the physical world where they couldn't get agreement. Indeed, the question is always asked why the Greeks didn't invent empirical science, when they did so much work in abstract thinking. The answer is because deep down they believed there couldn't be an empirical science. Because the empirical world was so imperfect and so variable that you couldn't have laws of how the empirical world behaves. So they never bothered with it. The same thing is true with technology, by the way. The Greeks invented steam power. They never used it for anything. It's a mental set. So, and we take the stars, you know, they didn't even think they were physical. Yeah.
Okay, but how can you prove, assuming there's no God, how can you prove that there, certain standards are, in the physical sense you can, but how can you prove in this one?
I'll come to that. But let me just register the force of the question. Let's say, I don't know how we can prove it. It doesn't follow that it can't be proved. It just follows that I don't know how we can prove it. to the alchemist also. He says, listen, you're in Paris, he's in Berlin, you correspond, and you can't agree on whether the experiment came out this way or that way. How can you prove what the truth is? What he would have to say, he's honest, is, I don't know how we can prove it. Doesn't follow, there's no way to prove it. It just means that he doesn't know how to prove it. It required a whole revolution of thinking to come to the right variables and then find out how you can prove it. But in the middle, they didn't know that.
Why should you consider, unless you have evidence for it, why should you even consider a possibility?
Okay, now let me explain. That's a good point here. I'm now putting the burden of proof on the believer in this theory. He says, without God, there is no standard of right and wrong. That's what he says. So I'm asking him, what reason do you have to hold that position? He's taking a position. I want to know his reason. If his reason is, we haven't found one yet, that's not a good reason for saying there is none. Now you ask me, what reason do you have for believing that there is one? That's a separate, that's a different question. And now let me explain to you, this is a slightly subtle point, but it's worth knowing, that in discussions with people, especially arguments with people, it's very important to establish what proposition you're investigating and upon whom is the burden of proof. Because one trick in discussion works like this. If I'm to take the defense P, and I'm presenting evidence, and you respond to the evidence, and I'm in trouble defending P, what I may do is say to you, well, how can you prove that P is wrong? Has your counter-argument proven that P is wrong? And usually it hasn't. Now, at that point, you ought to say to me, you switch the subject. You switch the subject. The question was, can you defend P? Not can I refute P. That wasn't the question. Those are two separate questions. We started with you defending P. If you're defending P, you have the burden of proof. You have to show why P is true. I, the critic, am not trying to show it's false. I'm just trying to see whether you have a good proof that it's true. I'm not taking the responsibility to show that it's false. I'm investigating your responsibility to show that it's true. If I'm successful as a critic, the conclusion will be, we don't know. We don't know whether it's true or false. You tried to show it was true. I'm showing you that your attempt to show it's true fails, and therefore we don't know whether it's true or false. So beware of someone who shifts the burden of proof. Now, I started off saying, you believe that without God there can't be absolute morality? I want to hear your reason. If he says, well, what's your criterion? He's shifting the burden of proof. I didn't say I had a criterion. All I said was, I want to hear from you why you think there can't be a criterion. The minute he says to me, well, you show me the criterion, he's given up. He's given up his position. He's admitting that he doesn't know whether there's a criterion or not. He hasn't got any good reason for thinking there isn't a criterion. The fact that I can't provide one doesn't mean that there isn't one. It just means that it could mean that we haven't found one yet. And therefore, the correct position would be, we don't know whether or not there's an absolute morality. Not we know for sure there isn't. That's a different position from the one that's usually taken. Yeah.
So, would you though, as a rabbi, would you agree that this objective standard, however, if we find one one day, it's going to have to match with what the Torah says?
Well, we'll come to that. That'll be Sunday and Monday. I told you. After you finish with this wrong position, I have to sketch the right position, and it is not simple. I told you, it's complicated and it's subtle and it's unintuitive in certain ways, and we'll have to work on studying in detail.
Is there a case for determining that there is no objective standard?
You know, I think it's very difficult. This is the kind of pessimism about human creativity, you know, that this problem will never be solved. One very good philosopher, Gilbert Harman, who is a relativist about ethics, says we've tried for a long, long time and we haven't achieved it, so looks like we're not going to succeed. But that's, you know, he himself understands it's not binding. He said, listen, since we've tried for so long and we haven't succeeded so far, it's worthwhile developing the other alternative. But he himself realizes it's not a conclusive argument, not by any means. Yeah.
Sounds like you're saying that the same morality has to apply to everyone.
Yes.
There's a reason that you can't have, say, look, I consider this to be good, I consider this to be evil.
The fit by morality, by definition, means standards that apply to everybody. Now, there are two misunderstandings here. I consider people have different opinions about truth also. That doesn't mean the truth is relevant. It just means that this person thinks this is the truth and that person thinks that's the truth. That doesn't make the truth relevant. It means that we are not all perfectly in tune with the truth. That's universal. That happens all the time. Right? Furthermore, to say that one rule applies to me and another rule applies to you doesn't make morality relative. You have rules that have conditions of application. I have two American citizens. Both are healthy. Both are literate. Both are sane. Both are non-criminals. One can vote and one can't vote. How could that be? Two American citizens. How could it be that one can't vote? Because he's 16 years old. That's why. What, you have different laws? That makes American law relative. Relative? Relative to what? One law says you have to be 18 in order to do this. No. So if so, then the 16-year-old can't and the 18-year-old can. That doesn't make American law relative. It means the laws have written into them that this law applies to this person and not to that person. That doesn't make the institution of American law relative, that it can be whatever you think, that everybody's opinion is as good as everybody else's. So the fact that there are different opinions doesn't make it relevant. The fact that the rules apply differently to different people doesn't make it relevant. Neither of those things has anything to do with morality being relevant. Yeah.
I'm saying this as addressing the point against the atheists about Nazis.
Yeah.
The atheists could answer that question by saying, you're right, maybe, I'm not saying there is no morality, but I'm going to say, look, if I don't believe in God, but I can say that this, I look at this thing is evil. Great. I don't have to say, I'm not saying that everybody's looking at it as evil, but why can't he say about himself that I look at that as evil?
The question is what he will mean by evil. Will he mean, I dislike it very much? Or will he mean, it has some objective characteristic, which is a reason for everyone to be against it? What does he mean by saying that it's evil? So when I say that, when a person says, X is evil, he's not just saying, I don't like it. Because then he doesn't expect anybody else necessarily to agree with him. You know? If you say that I don't like it, I don't like strawberry ice cream. I don't expect you to agree with me. It means nothing to me that you do like strawberry ice cream. We don't regard that as a disagreement in any way. We don't discuss and debate about that. I'm telling you my likes, and you're telling you your likes. If I say X is evil, and you say, no, it isn't, X is good, we regard each other as disagreeing with one another. We debate. We take the subject very seriously. We think it's extremely important that we have the different opinion. It's not treated like a statement of preference. Okay, second problem. With this. As I just say, the reason that's given for it is not an adequate reason. Now, let's see how it's supposed to work. For this point, I'll finish today. Okay. Without God, there is no absolute morality. With God's command, you get it. God says, thou shalt not steal. According to this view, that makes stealing wrong. That makes it. God says, pursue justice, that makes justice right. From justice, some kind of definition. God says, give charity, that makes giving charity right. His saying so makes it so. We should ask, what is it about God that determines His word as making things right and wrong? What quality of God is it that I could appeal to and say, well, why is stealing wrong? Because God said so. So what if God said so? But look, God is F. And F, you're F. That's it. Your word does it. Because you're F. What feature can I appeal to in God to explain why His saying so makes it so? So let's try a few. Let's take God is all powerful. God is all powerful. Oh, so God is all powerful. Okay, I got that. If He's all powerful, then when He says stealing is wrong, that makes it wrong. When He says charity is right, that makes it right. I hope it's obvious. There's no connection between power and right. There are lots of powerful people who are vicious criminals. And maybe the more power you get, the more vicious you become. Somebody said power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. So being is all powerful, and therefore when he says to do something, it becomes morally right. No connection at all. Omniscient. All knowing. Knows everything. Okay? He knows the whole decimal expansion of pi, which is an infinity of non-repeating numbers. Doesn't matter. He knows the whole thing. He knows everything. He knows where every grain of sand has been since the beginning of creation. Knows everything. So therefore, since he knows everything, when he says don't steal, it becomes morally wrong. It's apples and oranges. So what if he knows? Good. In our world, is there any correlation between the more you know and the more moral authority you have? Just apples and oranges. Doesn't seem to be any connection whatsoever.
Can't we say, though, that he doesn't know what's right and wrong?
He might, but he's saying so. Hadarabah, if you say that, you give it up the ship. Because you're telling me that there is something that's right or wrong before he says anything. Hmm. So you've given up the ship. This is a trick that we'll go through over and over again. Oh, okay. Well, his question. He says if he knows everything, then couldn't we at least say that he knows what's right and wrong? Because he knows everything? The answer is no, because then you've given up the ship. The whole idea was that before he commands anything, nothing is right or wrong. I'm coming to that. Correct. That's the last step. I just skipped ahead 2 steps. Yeah.
So as an all-knowing God, wouldn't you be bound to truth?
What's that saying?
As an all-knowing God, wouldn't you be bound to truth?
Why? Why couldn't it all...
To truth, but like you said before, truth is truth, and if you're not going against it, if you're going against it.
But in the fact, look, there are people who know an awful lot and lie. There's no correlation between knowing more and lying less.
Fine, so then we'd know the truth. You won't be bound to it.
No, we would know. He would know. We're imagining him now. His characteristic is he knows everything. Now, he says, don't steal. Does that make stealing wrong? Just because he knows everything?
He knows it, and he knows if it's true, if it's...
Right, but who says what he says is true? Number one. But you didn't catch what I said to him. If you're imagining that he knows what's true, that means including he knows that stealing is wrong, then somehow you're acknowledging that stealing is wrong before he commands it. Position we're considering is that nothing's wrong before he commands it. That's an egg before the chicken before the egg. Okay, there is an answer to this question, but in the very same way that we just mentioned, it undermines the position. What characteristic is it about God that gives his command its moral authority?
His will good.
So that I could say, because God is X, that's why when he says give charity, it becomes morally right. And when he says don't steal, it becomes morally wrong. The answer is there is a characteristic. It's called moral perfection. Since God is morally perfect, when he says do something, it's going to be the morally appropriate thing to do. He says don't do something, then it's going to be the morally inappropriate thing to do. This answers the question, but it destroys the position. Because the position was that until he says something, nothing is right, nothing is wrong, nothing is good, nothing is bad. What we're doing now is saying, I have to build a position like this. Number one, God is morally perfect. Number two, he said X. Number three, X is morally binding. But how did I get number one? How did I get that God is morally perfect if there is no morality until he commands it? Putting the chicken before the egg. And the cart before the horse. So this position that it's really a double position. Without God there is no absolute morality, and with God there is absolute morality. The second half can't get off the ground. There's no way to explain why when God says something it carries moral authority other than to say that he's morally perfect, and if you do that the judgment that he's morally perfect comes before there is morality according to their view. That can't be. So they can't give any explanation of how
God's command creates morality. Yeah.
What about envy and creator?
Oh, let's. I was wrong. I left that. I said it in two steps. What about being creator? God's creator. God is creator of everything ex nihilo, out of nothing. Okay, He created everything. So, when He says, "Give charity," it's morally right. Let's imagine a mini case. I'm going to talk about this tonight as well, but let's try to imagine a mini case. Watching the table here. Now watch here. Bang! Lassie. There's Lassie on the table. I just created Lassie out of nothing. I didn't even use any mass energy from elsewhere in the universe. I created the universe just went up one Lassie. Mass energy went up by one dog. So I created Lassie out of nothing. Now I have decided to torture Lassie to death. Very bitter, you know, the kind of thing that I would have used for Osama bin Laden. I created Lassie. Lassie is my dog. I created her out of nothing. Does that mean that when I decide to torture her to death, and she's not getting hold of a ball for this, right? Hold on, ball for dogs. She's not getting hold of a ball for this. She's going to torture her to death with excruciating pain. Then it's morally right to do so because I decided to do it because I'm her creator. The fact that something is a creator doesn't qualify it morally at all. Creator doesn't have to be good. No logical connection between being creator and being good. It's a why creator, not just creator. So that being the case, creator's not going to do it either.
The analogy isn't the same. You're
why?
God.
Why?
There was nothing beforehand. You make the rule. God makes the rules. You're already working in a set of
rules. So I'm showing you that idea of making the rules is not a competent idea, so at least when it comes to morality.
For this analogy, not for a God analogy.
Well, I ask you again. What is it about God that ensures when He says do X, it's morally right to do it? What feature of God is it that I can appeal to explain why it is, and when He says it, it makes it so? You say creator. So I ask you, if the fact that A creates the universe, does that mean that when He says afterwards, He says it, He's got to say it, right? If He doesn't say it, it's not moral. The morality comes into existence when He commands it. Before that, there's nothing right or wrong. Okay, so now He created the universe, and He says, don't steal. That's supposed to make stealing wrong. So I ask, what is there about Him that guarantees that stealing is going to be wrong when He says so? And to challenge someone who thinks there is such a feature, I say, can't you imagine a creator who says, my statement is, A should torture B until B dies.
Why is it wrong to torture the dog? To our mind, it's wrong to torture the dog, right?
Yes. Yes. To our mind, so okay, I'll answer this briefly. The longer answer will come on Sunday morning when I describe the positive position. But listen, one confusion that enters here, I will review all this tomorrow. If you have questions about what I'm saying now, I'll be glad to go backwards tomorrow. I do really want this to be understood. One question that always arises is this. You're talking about good and evil. Who says that what you mean by good and evil is what God means by good and evil? Maybe for Him, good and evil mean entirely different things. There are two problems. The simplest problem is this. God wrote a document for us concerning good and evil, among other things. He wrote it to communicate with us. So, these concepts are there for us to be able to understand His communication. If you assume that good and evil could be something entirely different, then His communication it turns out to be a mistake or a failure. So it can't be that the concepts of good and evil are entirely different. And good is really marshmallows or butterflies or tapioca pudding or, you know, it can't be like that. And good can't be gratuitous torture either, because that's the opposite of the concept that we have. That's what he communicated to us. More than that, I'm just giving you the headline. I'll do this in more detail tomorrow. There are limits beyond which you can't go using a concept that makes sense. Echo something I told you about the omnipotence. I say, look, you're thinking this is a table, right? But maybe, really, it's a tadpole. You've made mistakes before, haven't you? Well, maybe this is one of those mistakes. Right? Does the number 6 have parents? I know that sounds funny to you, but you've made mistakes before, haven't you? So maybe make a mistake about this also. Maybe the number 6 has parents. You know, there's a limit beyond which you can't go in stretching a concept that makes sense. Now, is the earth in motion or isn't the earth in motion? So for thousands of years, people were positive it's not in motion, discovered it is in motion. Very good. That's not the same as calling the table a tadpole, nor is it the same as saying the number 6 has parents. At a certain point, when you go beyond the limits of a concept, your suggestion makes no sense. I don't know what you mean. I don't know what you're talking about. You know. Do you have any square circles at home? What? Square circles? Gosh, I don't think so. Well, maybe you're wrong. Maybe you should go home and take a look. What would I look for? How would I tell whether I found one? You know, what should it do? What, in what kind of box should it fit? You know, my scramble box, which is round, or my cake box, which is square, or in my pentagon box, a square circle? At this point, you're just not making any sense. There's nothing in the suggestion, right? So, the two problems here, number one, he communicated to us with these concepts. That being the case, he's counting on our concepts for the communication. Therefore, the concepts can't be. And number two, philosophically, there are limits beyond which you can't go in stepping outside the boundaries of the concept and still make sense with the suggestion that you're making. Yeah.
And if Hashem created us and he's continuously recreating us, then doesn't that mean that we have the moral obligation to repay him for doing that by following his mitzvah?
We will come to yes, therefore.
So that can't be that. So wouldn't that mean that in addition to that moral obligation, which is aside from God, that we do that also everything he says becomes a moral obligation?
Good. You're absolutely right. That's Sunday Monday. That's our, but you need something outside and then use it for inside. That's the structure they're going to use on Sunday Monday. That's absolutely right. Yeah.
I want to ask you that God is perfect.
Does perfection include moral perfection?
Yes.
I mean, if it does, then you have my argument. And if it doesn't, then you have the other half. If it doesn't include moral perfection, then why should it say so? Make it not morally binding.